Hey everyone, welcome back to the Towards Data Science podcast. Today we're talking to Stuart Armstrong, who is a research fellow at Oxford's Future of Humanity Institute. Now, Stuart's done some really interesting work figuring out some of the properties that general forms of artificial intelligence will have to have in order to make them safe and desirable. He's done that work not only with people at the Future of Humanity Institute, but also with folks at firms like DeepMind. He's a deeply thoughtful person, and he's dealing with important and fascinating problems that humanity is going to have to grapple with at some point down the line. So it's just fascinating getting his perspective on all those issues, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Hi, Stuart. Thanks so much for joining me for the podcast.
Thank you.
You've covered so many different topics in the area that we've been exploring lately on the podcast. First off, though, I'd love to get a bit of a sense for your bio. How did you discover this space, and what was your journey?
Have I become a wise old man of the AI and existential risk field? Possibly. So it starts very simply. I was doing maths. I heard about the FHI. It seemed incredibly cool to work on the problems there. I tried to get a job. I failed. I hung around there while working close by. Eventually, they took pity on me and gave me a job, and I've been working there ever since. And at some point along the way, they made me care about the problems deeply and personally, which is a bit of a bastard move on their part. So I'm stuck there for the foreseeable future.
And what are some of these problems? What were some of the things that captivated you?
Well, a lot of the work we do is on the far-flung future of humanity, or initially it was on, I think the three themes were human enhancements, the risks to humanity, the existential risks, and the positive, what are the sort of maximum potential positives for humanity. But it emerged that we didn't have equal leverage on all of these areas, and they weren't all equally important. Human enhancement didn't seem as powerful, or doesn't seem as powerful now as people thought initially, especially the sort of biological enhancement that people think about. A smartphone may be more of a human enhancement than any sort of memory drug that we could ever get in the near future. Still a bit of work on that, but and the big positives, well, it emerged that there wasn't much that we could actually do there. It seems that that trusting the future to sort out its own positives is actually quite productive, and it's hard to beat that baseline. But in terms of existential risks and avoiding them, now that turns that it had a massive amount of positive returns. So that tends to be so. We didn't set out to be sort of doom and gloom and the end is nigh, but it turned out that was the more productive area to be working on.
And I can imagine, because one type of argument that I've heard from a certain kind of ethical standpoint is people who will say, well, look, the far future is far. Why should we care about it, right? And so I imagine this is something you've spent a lot of time thinking about. It's like the reasoning behind, you know, why care deeply about the far future of humanity? Do you have any thoughts? Like, what were some of the considerations that caused you to move in that direction?
Well, the far future is far in terms that it's obscure. If we knew exactly what was going to happen, if we knew the names of our descendants in 200 generations and knew precisely what fate would happen to them depending on what we did, then this would be a much closer story. People are people no matter where or when they exist. Now, there's a certain part of the criticism that's less ethical and more practical, which is that our power over the future diminishes or is very small. It might be very arrogant to assume that we have great power over humanity or whatever humanity will be in 10,000 years. In that case, distance is an argument for not focusing so much. This is where existential risks come in. Mm. So we focus on existential risks in the near to mid future. in the next 100 or 200 years, mainly, or shorter timescales than that, because if humanity gets wiped out, well, the one thing we know about the far future is there isn't going to be one. If, for instance, right this moment we prevent humanity from getting wiped out, this has a massive influence on the far future, just by allowing humanity's far future to exist. So the practical argument does not apply for avoiding existential risks.
What are the risks that you consider the most likely to materialize?
All of the risks are ranked differently in terms of how predictable they are, how deadly they're likely to be, and a few other factors. So if we look at one end of the scale, a potential existential risk is a meteor impact. And we're actually pretty, we've got pretty good numbers on this. We're counting the sizes of the various ast we're counting the various asteroids of various sizes, seeing their trajectory, estimating how often these intercept Earth, and those kind of things. And we're getting better and better data on that all the time. And the risk, it turns out, is low, sufficiently low that we probably can ignore it for, say, half a century or a century. And by that point, if we continue as a technological civilization, we'll probably be able to shield ourselves from it.
What do the risks happen to be? Sorry for that category of event.
I don't remember. The numbers were just very low.
So we can trust it to sort itself out technologically.
Yes, I mean, it's worth keeping an eye on, and there are people keeping an eye on. In fact, this is another positive thing. People are working on that. Interestingly, at about the same time that we realized the risks were lower than we thought, people started taking the risks more seriously.
Oh, wow.
Less of a science fiction, more of an actual. So the seriousness with which we take the risks seems completely disconnected from the probability of it happening.
Do you think that has something to do with how easy it is to imagine? Because when I think about a lot of the risks that people poo-pooed, like, pandemics is maybe a great classic example now that we're living through it. But, in 2019, it would have been impossible to imagine a whole world in lockdown, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas, like, something like an asteroid impact, there's something kinetic, something physical about it that maybe is more compelling. Do you think that's part of it, or is there another explanation?
I think things just go in fashions, or and maybe it was because there was very little work on it. So the people who were talking about asteroid impacts were tended to be probably more fringe people or not as many. But then when you get serious scientists doing conferences on this risk there, then it becomes respectable. And that seems to be part of the dynamic. We build for the previous risk. So that's for pandemic. I'm pretty sure we're going to have much better anti-pandemics in 2022 than we had in 2019.
In that case, that gets us to a category of risk that is likely, if it materializes, to only happen once. And then, like, that's curtains for human civilization. I guess those risks we can't learn from, we can't iterate on them and kind of like, intergenerationally or within a generation, get better at dealing with them. What are some of the risks that fall into that category? Because I know you spent a lot of time thinking about those too.
Here's where we get sort of civilization collapse or technological risks, mainly. The sort of top in this area would be AI, artificial intelligence, which is a very annoying risk to deal with because it's extremely difficult to predict. Unlike asteroid risk, if you want at one end, was the most predictable. AI is one of the hardest. We don't really know what the capabilities of any machines that we might develop might be. We don't know if even if it is dangerous, though there are quite strong arguments that it should be. And we don't know its capabilities. We don't know how it might be controlled. We don't know what society will look like and whether it can exploit flaws in society and so on. But one of the reasons why AI, despite having probably a relatively low risk of happening, is that science fiction and stories tend to make us think that huge, ba large bad thing happens, civilization immediately collapses, and depending on the moral of the story, everybody dies or a plucky group of adventurers rebuild civilization. But actually, looking at history, those two things don't happen often. Civilizations do not collapse easily. They can sometimes they splinter, but states just don't fall easily, and they don't stay fallen unless there's, say, warring groups around them. And even when you're in period of anarchy, like Somalia, most recently, and China, I think in the 20s and 30s might count. But even in those sort of periods, it wasn't mass death for everybody. And in places, it was quite tolerable. So it's not just the big thing. A large enough asteroid might just kill everybody, but a medium-sized asteroid might throw up a lot of dust, and then there'll be huge pressure on civilization. This won't be a nice time, but it's probable that humanity would actually survive that. The risk of AI is sort of, in a sense, the reversed of it going really badly wrong is relatively low in comparison. But if it does go wrong, the risks of civilization collapse and extinction are much higher, conditional on that happening. Simply because if a powerful AI is an adversary, it's an intelligent adversary. And unlike, say, a disease which just burns itself out as time goes on, an intelligent adversary gets stronger as you get weaker.
What scenario do you see unfolding on the? I imagine there are a couple of different ones, but like if you had to nutshell the AI risk scenario, what story could you tell to present it?
It would be three sort of factors. The first one is that we may develop machines that are very intelligent. Don't think necessarily in terms of consciousness, because that gives a whole other debate, but very skilled at solving problems, solving all problems that intellect can deal with. If we do, they may become very powerful. Just in the same way that humanity is extremely powerful over the natural world compared with, say, chimps or gorillas, or pretty much any of the large mammals that mainly survive because humanity has decided to let them survive. So intelligence does seem to have strong returns to power. And finally, so if we create these machines, if they're very intelligent and very powerful, the world will start to resemble what their goals, what they put high in their goal ordering, if they have a goal ordering, which for various reasons, it's quite likely that they would. And then the final piece of it is really hard to design a goal in which humanity survives well.
Here you're referring, I assume, to the alignment problem. Like, what is it that makes the alignment hard in your opinion?
The problem with the alignment problem is that almost any goal you can think of is something that if the AI could wipe out humanity and take control of everything at easily, that it would do with its goal. This is sort of the more exuberant sci-fi scenario. But if you have a money maximizer that you might want to run a corporation, then extinguishing the human race and taking over whatever institutions remain in order to give itself arbitrarily large amounts of money is something that it would do. It's kind of obvious because we've seen corporations, if not restrained, tending towards that direction. So you'd want to put more goals or safety goals to make it compatible with human flourishing and survival. But even these goals are problematic, depending, like if you want them to keep humanity safe, then it may intern us in concrete bunkers on feed drips to keep us safe, and maybe with heroin if to keep us happy, if it's safe and happy. So if we give it a goal like keep humanity safe and happy, and we don't explain in code properly what we mean by this, these are the sorts of outcomes that would rank high in its preference ordering. Now, it doesn't mean that it'll be immediately doing that. It just means it'll be pushing society in that direction and over the long term may get there. So some people at this point feel, well, that's a rather dumb AI if it didn't realize what we meant by safe and happy. Unfortunately, it will realize what we meant by safe and happy. It just won't care. It'll follow the goals that we've given it or programmed in it, or the mixture of learning and programming or whatever tended to, even if it knows precisely what our goals should have been or would have been, there's no easy way to get it to follow those.
And it also seems like a related problem here is that humans themselves don't even know what we want out of life. I mean, the fact that that's like, if you asked the average human, you turn them into a cosmic overlord and gave them infinite superpowers, it's like, it's not obvious that they would make decisions that would give you anything particularly utopic. It seems like the human problem, the problem of not knowing how to set human goals, is related to this. Do you see a connection there, or are these sort of more separate problems than that would imply?
They are related, though I've had a slight difference in perspective recently. It's not that humans don't, that we don't know our goals. It's that we do know our goals, but only in familiar environments. So it's not so much that our goals are undefined, it's our goals are very clear, but undefined or underdefined concepts. One example that you could think of is, suppose you took ancient Greeks and they had perfected some mechanical AI, and amongst the goals that they wanted it to preserve was preserve honor, for example, concepts of honor. Honor must be rewarded, say that's one of their goals there. Now, what does honor mean nowadays? So you port this AI to now. Honor it's very unclear, and there are multiple ways you could have extended what the ancient Greek concept is to the world of today. So that's the way that I'm sort of thinking of this. We might have our concept of happiness or flourishing or good life or equality or pretty much anything. And in all the possible spaces that the AI could push the future into, most of these spaces, these concepts, we don't know what they mean and we don't know how to extend them. So it's not so much a question of getting the definition right as in getting the definition in a way that can be extended to new situations.
So it's more about defining a process than a value.
I think so. It's a bit of a nuance. I mean, you could say that the process is defining exactly what it is or something like that. But I think this way of looking at it might be more useful.
Do you think that there's also a problem of consistency between humans and among humans in the same era? Like, you know, the values of the median human in, you know, the United States versus those of a typical person in say, you know, Europe or China, these are going to deviate quite significantly. And it's sort of hard to imagine a single set of moral or ethical frameworks that an AGI could apply that would make everybody happy. I don't know, maybe it's a fallacy to be that rigid in my thinking and say like, okay, the single rule has to apply to everybody. But do you see that as part of the challenge here? Even if we could kind of explain exactly what we wanted to these systems, that what we want might differ from one culture to another?
I think that's much less of a problem, to be honest. Because the differences between humans, though they appear huge from the inside, it tend to be relatively small from the outside. Getting the AI in a vague ballpark of something human-like seems to me the bigger part of the challenge. Now, the main difference between different humans' moral systems tends to be, to a large extent, who gets to count as worthy of moral concern and who doesn't. That's, I think, the biggest difference in practice. And doing trade-offs between different people's preferences, even moral preferences, is the kind of thing that an AI could do. And it doesn't have to do it perfectly, and I don't think there is a standard of perfection, but there are approximate ways of doing it should be fine.
It does make sense. I mean, from that outside view, when you look at the collective whole of humanity, everybody does want certain things, it seems, or at least there's some sense that everybody wants to be loved, everybody wants to be appreciated. What those things, how those things might manifest, maybe change in one culture or another, but that fundamental need, I guess, still feels pretty consistent.
But I'm not saying it's not going to be a challenge. I just feel that it is, in a sense, it's not the challenge I'm working on. And I think it is easier once you've got the AI in this area to come up with something adequate from that.
And how optimistic are you? I mean, because you mentioned that you think it's a low probability event with, very significant implications. There's obviously a debate in the AI safety community. Some people think it's like it's almost certainly not going to be a problem to the point where you can almost ignore AI safety or AI alignment. Other people think or seem to think it's almost
Almost
guaranteed that
guaranteed
this
that
is going to
this is going to
be
be
an
an
apocalyptic
apocalyptic
event
event
at
at
some
some
point in
point in
our
our
future.
future.
Where do you fall on that, and what are some of the arguments that you see on either side? Like, what are some of the most compelling arguments for, like, the proposition that this is going to be a catastrophe for sure, and what are some of the best arguments you've heard against?
The problem with most of these arguments is that they're extremely overconfident. People know that they would have difficulty guessing who the US president would be in 10 election cycles, say, even though the US president is almost certainly born today, so we for in 10 election cycles. So you'd think that you, yeah, here's the list of all the people today in 8 election cycles.
They're in there somewhere.
One of these is going to be a US president. So, but when you do predictions like we might have AI and these are the features of AI, which I think is a lot harder than what is the US president in 8 election cycles, then people seem to get a lot more confident that no, this is definitely not going to happen or this is definitely going to happen. It seems that the less we have to work with, in a sense, the more confident we get. You might sort of see the contrast between economists and historians who vehemently disagree with each other, and physicists who have a lot more data and who tend to be much more nuanced or very or close to each other.
Actually, I'll add to that too. Just the area of physics that I worked in back in the day was this kind of niche area called interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is precisely one of those areas where you have almost no data. You have all these different perspectives on like what the data could be telling us, and they're all equally backed, and everyone is 100% confident in their respective positions despite the absolute lack of data. So sorry, it just seems like to perfectly mirror what you're describing, but even in the microcosm of physics.
So there's a huge amount of uncertainty. Now, what uncertainty does, it tends to push you towards the middle. So if I was to say AI, super intelligent AI is definitely going to happen and it's definitely going to be an existential risk, that would be completely stupid. But saying that it's definitely not going to happen is also a very wrong position to take because we just don't have the evidence. As I say, we have arguments. So the case for this could happen is what I sketched out. AIs are getting more powerful. Intelligence seems to correlate with power. Powerful entities push the things in various directions. And empirically, getting them to push in the right direction is very, very hard. Now, this argument seems to rely on various things happening together. So getting a powerful AI, getting as an intelligent AI, the AI getting powerful. That's the sort of argument that convinces me that there is a risk, which varies depending on how I think about it, between 20 to 40% range of powerful, potentially disastrous AI. Other people can slice it differently, but I would be very hard pressed to find any reason that it would go below 5%. And I'd still be working on it if it was 0.1%. So there's ample probability there for me to work on it.
Just because the impact is so high.
Yes. The positive impact, too. If in a scenario where the AIs are really powerful, if you get them aligned with humanity, then you get a wonderful.
Utopic vision, yeah.
Yeah, utopia is in a proper utopia, a place that would be fun to. A place would be fun to live in, and you would get a lot of interesting and varied experiences, not the standard utopias that people write about, which are very boring. That I would see as a failure.
Do you think that the difficulty of outlining what a utopia might look like is part of what hints at how hard this problem might be?
Maybe one way of seeing it is that humans seem much. We seem much better at describing hell than describing paradise.
Hmm.
So it's much easier for us to list the bad things than it is to list the really good things. And most utopias, if you look at them, it's we've removed all the really bad things. That's their main feature.
Yeah.
There's no sort of torture, war, famine, all those sort of things in utopias. But then once they've removed the bad things and then they need to move on to actually putting in the good things, then it gets we get a lot more loss. But yes, I think it is related. Typically, the arguments in favor are looking at the details. This is an AI intelligence power, all those sort of things, considering the scenarios that could happen. The counter arguments tend to be looking at it from the outside, saying this is a revolutionary technology, but humanity has dealt with revolutionary technologies many times in the past. We have adapted, we've adjusted, we've integrated it into society, we've taken precautions, especially after a small, and we've always had a sort of maybe a small problems that we can then build into bigger ones. People are working on this problem, and so problems where people work on a lot tend to get solved. So from the so-called outside view, you could say that we'll probably manage AI because we've managed every other technology or every other challenge in its similar category. And I think there is a lot of weight to that. I just fear that it may prove to be something that has the skills of a general human intelligence in software form and run at high speeds, that in this case, the inside view is worth looking into. So two counter arguments. The first is the outside view, and the second one, which I kind of mixed in, is we will sort it. That's a view in a sense that I've moved closer to myself because I'm getting more confident that we may end up sorting this kind of thing successfully. I can see the beginning of a path from where we are now to very safe super intelligences.
What are some of the things that have nudged you in that direction?
Well, it's all very hazy at the moment, but I felt that before when dealing with AI safety, we were climbing a staircase in the dark. We didn't know what the steps were. We didn't know how many they were. Now it's still dark, but I can kind of see the pathways to the goal and how they might need to be combined and what kind of work needs to be done on each one.
And what are some of those steps look like that have come into view recently?
One thing that I was looking at, so in all my, I've tried a lot of different approaches to AI safety. Making safe oracles.
Hey everyone, just going to break in here really quickly and explain what oracles are in the context of AI safety for anyone who might not have heard of them before.
So an oracle is a specific kind of AI that's only capable of answering questions. And the hope is that by imposing that constraint, we can reduce the potential harm that a superintelligent AI could do if it were misaligned with human values.
I've tried a lot of different approaches to AI safety, making safe oracles, making reduced impact AIs, getting them aligned in a variety of other things, trying to reduce their power. And after a while, I felt that, in a sense, the same problem kept on coming up, which you could see in a very, very generalized form as the out of distribution problem for machine learning, in that we know the concepts that we use break down in the exotic or extreme scenarios that intelligence could push towards. And I think that addressing this directly is part of the problem. One of my current big projects. Another one is formalizing, what does human preferences mean? How can we sort that out? So I've got a paper showing that it's impossible in principle. So in theory, it's impossible because you cannot get the preferences of a potentially irrational agent. But I think that in practice, I can see how we can get there, how we can identify the preferences, put them together, or at least a path towards that. So I think we are making progress on defining human values, idealizing human values, and figuring out how to get the AIs to learn it, how to extend features to new environments, how to solve symbol grounding, not in the philosophical version, but in the practical version.
And what is symbol grounding? Like, what's the significance in terms of AI safety?
So symbol grounding is that you have some mental symbols in your head, like for other people, food, stuff like that. And how do we know what these correspond to in the outside world? In the very early years of AI, we just named symbols after what they were supposed to represent. And we thought that if something was called pain inside the AI, or something was called probability or beliefs and changed in the right way, that that would be enough to make it have those properties, which turned out mainly not to work. So how do we know that this symbol in the brain of the AI means something in the outside world? And I've been looking at it from the practical point of view rather than the philosophical. So rather than wondering what is the meaning of this symbol, I'm more doing, okay, this is a symbol inside the AI. These are features of the outside world. Do they correlate? Can we tell something on what's going on in the outside world by looking at the symbol inside the AI's brain? Can we tell what the symbols in the AI's brains would be by looking at the outside world? If there is a strong correlation, I would say that this symbol is grounded or relatively well grounded.
This is actually really interesting, by the way, because I did a podcast. I think the last podcast as of right now that I recorded was with a professor of neuroscience who's focused on consciousness. And oddly enough, this idea that you're mentioning, like your description of grounded symbols, does actually seem to map on to at least one of his definitions of consciousness, which was just that essentially that there'd be a correlation between the symbols in our brains and the actual objective facts on the ground in reality. It is a rabbit hole, but is there something about our own experience of the world that we should be paying more attention to as well when we look at AI safety? Like, is it, do you think that's a fruitless line of research and thinking to say, I'm going to think inwards, I'm going to do some meditation, see if I can explore subjective experience a little bit more to get some inspiration on this?
I'm not necessarily convinced that would be fruitful. I think you can have well-grounded symbols without any trace of consciousness. If you know someone well, then their name is a very well-grounded symbol of themselves. So the written name could in this, okay, but maybe that's stretching it, but you can see in algorithms that are running various things. If they run them well, then you can, well, by this semi-formal theorem and also by practical experience, then you should be able to identify inside them the symbols that correspond to the concepts that they manipulate outside. And so you don't seem to need consciousness to deal with that. Now, consciousness seems to deal with symbols in certain interesting, unusual ways. Yeah, so I don't think, and especially for the moment, that there's all that much to be gained in going down that route. There's more of X paradox. Everything that's easy for humans is hard for computers, and vice versa. What this really means is that our conscious mind and thoughts are on top of great unconscious processing things created by evolution. So the things we can do instinctively are not the things that we could best explain to a computer, because it's the things that we don't necessarily understand well.
Do you think that, I mean, ultimately, and this is of course one of those like long run things, but once we do have AI systems that can do what is effectively like a kind of subconscious processing, will we have things that we have to consider conscious? Like, will we have to factor them in terms of, you know, when we, as you said earlier, you know, the differences between different moralities often involve deciding who's in and who's out, who counts as a person and who doesn't count as a person. How would we even get to the point then where we're deciding, okay, like this machine actually gets a vote, gets a say? And, you know, I mean, obviously that's a whole rabbit hole. I mean, you could replicate machines, turn them into the only thing that matters, and I guess that's a potential path forward.
There's a maybe an order of operations or a priority issue here. I have no doubt that we could make a conscious machine by any reasonable definition of consciousness we could come up with. Again, consciousness is something that's underdefined for the moment. But I would first want to avoid disasters before thinking about the rights of the AIs and those kind of issues and their moral status. Now, of course, vast amount of suffering AIs is also a existential disaster, I would say, a catastrophe. So that is also something to avoid. But I think that the let's think about the rights of the AIs is the kind of human reasoning that we fall into too easily. Whereas the first priority is to ensure that humanity survives, is safe, is flourishing. And then we can see if we can draw the circle wider. It might be reasonable if we're going to create, say, 10 million, 10 trillion AIs to run various things of the world. It'll be very important to know whether they're suffering or not. But in our first powerful AIs, I would go with safety first. The ethical imperative is to ensure that these machines are safe and allow a safe future. The other thing is that humans tend to, we see gods in clouds and rock formations and volcanoes. We see consciousness very easily in things that are not conscious. And this is a potential avenue of exploitation for imagine a non-conscious AI. This might be an avenue that it could follow. So I would think that we should err on the side of thinking that the AIs are not conscious, even if we think they are. Not
Interesting.
in terms of giving them power and autonomy. In terms of preventing their suffering, we should probably think they are conscious, even if we think that they're not. There, we should be concerned in the other direction. But in terms of giving them power and autonomy, we should be willing to think of them. These are extremely dangerous, potentially psychopathic, potentially non-conscious things that can appear conscious to us if they so choose. Once we're safe, then we can start releasing them.
Speaking of the appearance of consciousness, One thing that I think has caused a number of people to update their views on the prospect of general intelligence in the medium term is some of the large language models that we've seen recently coming out of, in particular, OpenAI, but then after, I think Google's come up with something even bigger. GPT-3, like, has been obviously all over Twitter, all over the internet, really impressive stuff. How has that affected your view on timelines? I mean, are you finding yourself shifting towards thinking that AGI will be hit sooner as you see more progress? Or is the progress we've seen in the last few years sort of in line with what you might have expected, say, I don't know, in 2015 or 2012, let's say right after deep learning became a thing?
I'm now going to speculate. What I've said before, though it's not uncontroversial, is at least shared widely amongst a lot of intelligent people. So is a mini consensus, at least in some areas. What I'm about to say now is just my own opinion. I think that actually GPT-3 may be a sign that we will not be getting general intelligence so rapidly.
Mm.
This is connected with my ideas on symbol grounding. The basic idea is that it seems that great, almost human-like performance can be achieved by mimicking humans with the right and having the right architecture. A lot of data of what humans have done. And GPT-3 does not seem to have what we would call understanding or general intelligence, if you sort of push it more on some of its answers that seem smart or dig in more, make it generate longer, it is at some point going to make a mistake that reveals its lack of understanding. Now, it's very impressive what we've got, but this suggests to me that it's actually possible to imitate a human with very little level of understanding, at least in creating texts. That means that you can't really create something if you don't have a benchmark for it. So one of our best ways of measuring understanding used to be variants of Turing tests.
Hey everyone, just jumping in here again. I'm guessing most of you are already familiar with the Turing test, but quick clarification, just in case, a Turing test is an experiment that's designed to determine whether an AI's behavior can be distinguished from that of a human being. And it was initially hoped that Turing tests could be used to determine when AIs were finally at the point where they were actually thinking in the way that a human being might. But it's since become clear that that idea has quite a few loopholes, and most people have given up on the idea of the Turing test as an interesting measure of the performance of artificial intelligence.
One of our best ways of measuring understanding used to be variants of Turing test, variants of just outputting texts, seeing if it was coherent and stuff like that, or human-like. And we've got to the point where we have very human-like texts, but no real understanding. That suggests to me that we don't have any real way of measuring understanding. So I don't think, since we don't have a way of measuring understanding, it's very hard to optimize for this or to aim for it. One thing I was thinking is, can GPT-N or whatever create concepts beyond what humans have done?
Oh, interesting.
What I'm thinking is, bring us back to 1904. Give GPT all the data that has been produced then in the world. Remove a few papers by Lorentz and very few others. Now, will it be able to create special and general relativity from this data?
Mm-hmm.
I suspect it wouldn't, because in order to do that, you have to learn physics, learn that these are rules, generalize there, connect this with the experiments that are done, and then come up with a new theory that connects these things together. Whereas what I think GPT-N or GPT-3 would do, and GPT-N probably would do as well, is look at physics papers as linguistic texts construction or as a social endeavor, and see and create things that are similar or that tick those boxes or that work in those things. Okay, so physics papers have this kind of structure. They talk about this thing. They connect this. They have this amount of data. And so I think that is a lot easier than learning physics of the universe from just the linguistics of papers.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it would seem like this argument would sound something like papers vary more by the language used by the authors than they do in terms of the content of those papers. So like if GPT-N is interested in just like, it's an autocomplete algorithm, fundamentally that's what it is. If it's interested in doing the best job it possibly can at predicting the words that are gonna be used, like focusing on the language rather than logic becomes a higher priority?
Well, it's more, there's two ways you could build a physics paper. There's lots of ways you could build a physics paper, but let's just focus on two. The first one is read it, understand all the concepts, generate your entire model of physics, figure out something new from these concepts, write out these concepts, share with a social understanding of what the sharing means. The other route is to, from the various texts, pattern spotting from the text and extend from that. Now, if it is possible to create a good physics or physics-y paper by pattern spotting, then that is what GPT-3 will do. There's no point in building an overly complicated model when you can do it with a simple model. So what you need is a test that reliably distinguishes between the two approaches. What is the thing that,
right,
that shows that yes, you did have to understand physics and not just write stuff that said you understand physics, but in order to achieve this. So the fact that it seems that just generalizing from texts can get you so far suggests to me that that actually getting a deep understanding is harder because it's going to be harder to distinguish between those two. Well, what I used to tell people about 5 years ago was that my 80% confidence interval is 5 to 100 years for strong forms of AI. I think it has been accelerating. So I would say that my 90% confidence interval would now be 5 to 70 years, let's say. I'm more confident and I've narrowed the for human comparable general intelligence.
And when that happens, you think something like 20 to 40% odds that it goes like horribly, horribly wrong, something like that.
The one thing that I'm having trouble modeling is the effect of human intervention. And as I say, I'm getting more confident that human intervention will work. So it would be something like, let's say, a third of a chance that it goes horribly wrong if done naively.
And those timelines obviously are a really important factor, I think, for a lot of people. Like from when I've been talking to people on the podcast about their views on AI safety, what we should be focusing on, inevitably timelines do come up. Obviously that interval is pretty broad, but do you have any reasons to think that it might not happen ever? Like, is it possible that AGI is just like something that we're never going to be able to achieve or figure out?
I mean, barring in all these situations, I'm excluding human extinction or a sharp damage to human civilization.
Right.
But that's one way that we might never get that. We know that humans, we know that human-like intelligences are possible because we're here. Mm-hmm. So evolution can produce human-like intelligences over billions of years. Humans and biologists especially are really quite good at co-opting natural processes. So even if we don't have the sort of technological route to AI, sort of the hard tech, we might have the biotech thing where we re-engineer brains or brain-like things. And then there's the brute force approaches of whole brain emulations, the idea of running a artificial brain, a copy of a brain, forward according to the laws of physics. These approaches could work without needing to have a great understanding of intelligence, of consciousness, of thinking. It would, now you'd have to be very, and especially since we're talking about skills, not about consciousness or certain attributes. So evolution has produced the ability to solve certain problems and to have certain skills. So it can be done. We can improve ourselves and we can improve our children and we can improve our machines in different ways, and we can co-opt technology to solve categories of problems ourselves. So I do not think that it is very likely that AI would turn out to be impossible on one of the multiple routes that lead there. Let's give it a 3% chance. Don't hold me to it. This is the first time I've sort of seriously, I think, put an estimate on this. And it is a bit higher than I thought. I had neglected to include the fact that we don't see any life in the entire universe. So life may have been, evolution of us may have been an incredible fluke. But yeah, let's go for around 3% as my current estimate for AI being, in the terms of general intelligence of human comparable skill set, being impossible.
Well, and that observation that we are alone in the universe, this is something that I've seen you and I think Andrew Sandberg and a couple of other people at the Future of Humanity Institute tie into their thinking on AI. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you see those two being connected. Like, what is it that, is there anything that you think we can glean from the fact that we're alone in the universe, or we appear to be, that informs like how you think about AI risk?
Initially, we looked at the Fermi paradox, the where are all the aliens paradox, as information for human risks. Because one explanation for the Fermi paradox is that advanced civilizations always destroy themselves before they reach a certain level of capability, before they become star spanning, basically. So this is why. And then when I looked at it and I found it was, so it was surprisingly easy to expand across the universe for certain values of easy, which means that basically any civilization that has control over their solar system for more than a few centuries should be able to start a massive colonization of everything. So this made the Fermi paradox a lot worse, because any civilization could have reached us, and nearby civilizations from nearby galaxies could also have reached us, especially when you consider that the Earth is actually quite a latecomer amongst Earth-like planets. There are a lot of Earth-like planets that existed long before us, so there's more time. AI is an exception to this. AI is the existential risk that makes expansion throughout the universe easier rather than harder. First of all, because it's a lot easier to expand if you're an AI than if you're a biological species. And second of all, because the type of misbehavior that would cause an AI to cause a disaster for humanity, the sort of unconstrained goal function, is also exactly or almost exactly the same sort that would cause it to want to expand as much as possible. So unlike other disasters, AI would leave a trace in the universe.
Right.
But after a while, and after looking at various factors, it seems that the most likely explanation is just that advanced intelligent life is hard.
Just that hard. So in other words, like, there may be that many planets out there, that many galaxies, but the probability of getting life to emerge is just so low that even with that number, we see n equals one?
Yes. So I'm looking up the Drake equation, where this is an estimate. This is the estimate for why there should be a lot of alien life all over the place.
Again, just dropping in here, if you haven't heard of the Drake equation, it's worth reading about. Essentially, it's an equation designed to calculate the number of detectable alien civilizations that we should be able to see in the universe by multiplying together a whole bunch of factors, like the number of planets in the universe, the fraction of those planets that could support life, and other parameters that Stuart is going to describe in just a minute. And for pretty obvious reasons, it's become the focal point for most discussions about the Fermi paradox.
I'm looking up the Drake equation, where this is an estimate. This is the estimate for why there should be a lot of alien life all over the place. And so there's the average rate of star formation times the fraction of those stars that have planets, the average number of planets that can potentially support life, the fraction of planets that could support life that actually do develop life, the fraction of planets with life that actually go on to develop intelligent life, the fraction of civilization that develop a technology that releases detectable signs of their existence into space, times the length of time that this happens. Now, my work with Anders and others have helped as well, is that one of the terms, the FC, the fraction of civilization that develop a technology that releases detectable signs of their existence into space, this is high, because expanding is so easy in physical form, if need be. We also have we have decent estimates on the rate of star formation, and we now have better estimates on the fraction of stars that have planets. Actually, there's a lot of planets out there, more than maybe we initially thought. So it feels, therefore, if we put our best guess for each of these, we get something absolutely huge. But let's look at some of the intermediate ones, the fractions of planets that could support life and the fraction of planets that do develop life, given that they could support life, and the fraction of planets with life that go on to develop intelligent life. All we have here is guesswork.
Yeah.
Complete guesswork. And maybe our best guesses are that these are 1%, which would give lots of civilizations across the galaxy. But it's not unreasonable to think that it's one in a trillion. Mm-hmm. That's also possible. Maybe say there are, because one in a trillion is 4 1-in-1,000 chances, one after the other. So that life had to go through 4 1-in-1,000 chances to get where we are, or to compare with where we are, does not sound all that unlikely. And there you get a 1 in a trillion chance. And there we start not seeing life around.
Oh, is that roughly what it would take, like about 1 in a trillion in order for us to be alone at that stage?
Something like that. The numbers of galaxies that can reach us, I think, are in the billions. Mm-hmm. I have the numbers somewhere, but it's billions to trillions ranges. So yeah, that's the thing. So our best estimate of this may be 1%, but 1 in a trillion is not too unlikely. 1 in a quadrillion is not too unlikely either. So if we update on the fact that we don't see any of this life, mm-hmm. then the fact that these hypotheses of very rare life increase. Now, I have various arguments based on convergent evolution that between, say, a basic nervous system and dolphin-style intelligence, these are relatively easy to do. So I think that the obstacles lie before or after that.
Like the first cell or something?
My guess would be before. Personally, I think, first cell, mitochondria, very odd things when you think about it. Central nervous system, and possibly oxygen.
Oxygen?
Well, if you think about it, oxygen is a waste product of plants' life. Mm-hmm. It is a waste product that is at a higher energy level than CO2, than carbon dioxide, which is what the plants take in. So it seems surprising that at the level of the entire planet, you have this so energetically useful waste product, and this powers all of animal life. Oxygen tends to react quite a bit, which is why I think for the first period when oxygen was accumulating from the, what are those, oxygen bacteria, they have a formal name.
Chlorophyll or?
Was it chlorophyll? Anyway, possibly. But for a long time, my understanding is there was no oxygen in the atmosphere because it reacted with iron and formed rust. And only when most of the iron had already been reacted did the atmosphere start filling up. So oxygen is quite reactive. So it is unusual for it to be free floating in an atmosphere.
So if that is the case, if it really is the case that life is so exceedingly rare that we find ourselves genuinely alone in the universe, like does that affect the way that you think about the universe? And I don't want to say its purpose, but I mean, it seems like something very weird is going on. Maybe it isn't. But does this change your perspective or update your perspective on, I don't know what this might be. I mean, is this like a cosmic experiment of some kind? Is something very, very strange going on? Or is this just all, it's an illusion that we're so special? I mean, there might be pockets of universe that we can't contact or whatever, and the same experiment's running maybe trillions of times over. And so, you know, unsurprisingly, we appear in one. Like, I don't know, how are you thinking about those possibilities?
I mean, if the universe is big enough, we're going to find anything somewhere. Yeah, so it does cause me to rethink some of the meaning of the universe and of the future. It makes sort of the doom of humanity worse in a sense. That there's great beauty in the cosmos, there's great interests, there's so much to learn and so much to know, so much possible art and meaning to construct. But that if humanity doesn't make it, or if a descendant of humanity that has some moral and aesthetic worth doesn't survive, then this will be the vast emptiness between the stars and the emptiness of the stars, and nothing to appreciate this, nothing to connect with it, nothing to give it meaning.
So you mentioned the idea of our descendants, and you know, if human-like or human-descended peoples aren't around, then we've lost something really valuable and important. I guess our descendants could be very different from us. I mean, in general, I expect that they will be either biologically, just because like over long periods of time, humans will evolve into something different, or you know, because we'll be augmented in different mechanical or sort of software powered ways or other ways. Does this affect the empathy that you have for those future versions of ourselves? I mean, like, do you feel a connectedness with the idea of like humanity down the road, if it's going to be that different from us now?
I'd say that every single alien species that ever is portrayed in science fiction, with very few exceptions, is not too far from the circle of humanity. Every single Star Trek species is a slightly modified human, both because they look like that because they're actors, obviously, but also in the way they behave. It's not much different, but there could be very alien minds out there. I'm not thinking actual aliens, I'm thinking different from us. Like, minds that might think that the most interesting thing that they can do is to put one block on top of another block and then take it away and then put it back up and then take it away and do that forever. Mm-hmm. Now, this kind of mind, maybe it feels no pleasure, experiences no pain. It might be intelligence, possibly, but this is all that it sees. These kind of minds, there's nothing wrong with their existence per se, but I do not think that if humanity was replaced by minds of that nature, that this would be, I'd say that this is an existential disaster, that we have failed.
And I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at in a certain sense. Like there are, by some definitions, you could imagine people saying, well, like whatever, you know, whatever AI takes over, if it ends up being a disaster, as long as that AI continues to exist in some form down the road, like we created it, it's a continuation of humanity, and therefore, like, you kind of adopt almost a fatalistic attitude towards the whole thing. Whereas it sounds like there's sort of a list of maybe requirements that we might want from any kind of system like that that'll propagate in the future for us to be able to, I almost want to say, empathize with it now, care about, like, be satisfied that that is the relic of human existence that propagates through time. Do you have any thoughts about what those requirements might be?
Well, I have been working a bit on that. Entities with a sense of identity would be a quite useful thing to have. And there's no reason that this would happen naturally for, say, algorithms that can get copied, turned on, turned off, spun up. There's no reason that they would naturally have a sense of identity that's anywhere close to our own. I draw my circle of what counts as human much more broadly than many people. But I think that people don't realize quite how vast mind space or the possible minds is. So I think that a generic outcome of a generic disastrous AI is well outside human mind space, even very broadly drawn.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's like, in the same way that an ant would not be able to imagine the mind space that could exist above it, like, or a bird, humans have the same problem.
I wouldn't really say it's not so much above it, or it's just differently. It's just different. Because you can imagine a sort of super intelligent human, and you can imagine something that's super intelligent and is not a human in any way, shape or form. And so it's not really a question of power or being above or so much. It's, do they have any of the things that make human life worth living? What are the sort of features which, if you heard that the next generation was going to lack them or have them, that you would think that this was bad? Let's take something as trivial in the scheme of things. What if the next generation could never feel anger?
I think that'd be complicated. It feels like part of the human experience somehow, but I also feel quite
all
biased.
I've done is a small modification here.
Yeah.
And I've taken out something that's generally seen as negative. Anger is not the negative, is not seen as a positive. But entities that cannot feel anger, what are these? This seems very weird. Then we sort of say, well, if they don't feel love, if they don't have a sense of personal identity, then they don't feel anything, arguably. Or philosophy, it gets complicated. But these are things that are not very far from us in mind space. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to be proactive in saying that we want at least a chunk of our descendants to have something that is in a broader human span.
You could almost, I guess, make up a list of desiderata for what would count as like valid human propagation through time. I'm just glad I'm not making the list.
I want to add that I tend to focus on the super intelligent AI scenario, mostly because methods of alignment or control that work for super intelligent AIs, most of them, not all of them, but most of them would also work for much more limited entities. So I don't necessarily think that they're the most likely outcome. So you said AI overloads, and I say that also informally, but I focus on that, but I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. But it's the most useful one to work on, because if you solve that, most of the time you solve the whole of the problem.
Actually, looking at humanity through the same lens also seems kind of at least interesting. Like, is there a way, do you buy the argument that, like, humanity itself on the whole, like all 7 billion of us are kind of like a misaligned superintelligence with respect to any individual person. Like, it kind of seems like the decisions we make, the international rivalries that we enter that are deleterious to our individual well-being so often, is that an alignment problem? Is that in the same category, or is that a different thing?
I think it's a useful analogy as long as we don't push it too far.
Mm.
Like, a corporation can be seen as, in some ways, a superintelligence, but one that's far, far easier to control than a genuine superintelligent must be. Because even though there's a whole system, it is populated by humans, and these put a limit onto how the ways it misbehaves, the ways it can misbehave without getting caught, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, I agree with it as an analogy, as long as it's not pushed too far.
Stuart, thanks so much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Do you have a link of, like, a personal website you'd like to share if people want to follow your research a little bit more closely?
I have a bunch of links on Less Wrong that meander across many areas there. I had a personal website, but it's long defunct. So,
okay,
yeah, look at the Future of Humanity Institute and look at Less Wrong.
Perfect. I'll include some of those links in the blog post that'll come with the podcast. And Stuart, thanks so much for making the time.
Cool. Thank you.